at the end of the first group that I had, we were like having a wrap up and a saying goodbye. One of them said, like, "You're the only one who likes us. No one else in the company likes us. You're the only one who likes us. You're like the queen of the millennials." And I'm like, "Oh, ding." And I went on GoDaddy and I got the URL.
From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin. Our mission on this podcast is to help you realize your dreams of doing meaningful work. Here you'll meet and be inspired by amazing people who overcame great odds. You'll discover what sparked them, how they explored work opportunities, the strategies that they employed to ensure career success, and the actions they boldly took to make it all happen. You'll also meet esteemed and nationally recognized thought leaders who are helping people like you to develop work skill, experience and leadership, and seize opportunity from a changing world so that your beautiful work dreams turn into reality. Together, let's turn work meaningful, for meaningful work is the future of work. Nicole Russo is not a millennial, and yet the queen of millennials, as she is known within the professional coaching ranks, is successfully empowering workers from all demographic cohorts to learn from and embrace the generation that now comprises the largest part of the American workforce. A former corporate executive with deep experience in leadership and training, Nicole's current mission is to help leaders in companies successfully harness their millennial workers' buoyant energy and collaborative working style. For those companies that channel millennial skill and perspectives best will succeed, while others that don't will be left in the dust heap of change. Her work impacts not only the C-suite, but millennial workers as well, whom she counsels privately to define their strategic purpose, recruit and hire people, launch successful sustainability and corporate social responsibility programs, and guide their careers so that they may live their dreams of doing meaningful work. We also discover how Nicole, a self-described introvert, mastered public speaking and now helps her clients to disappear their fears. We met up with Nicole Russo in September 2019 over Skype from her family's home in Western Massachusetts. Nicole Russo, welcome to The Tightrope.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So you grew up in the Berkshires, specifically in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. What was life like for you growing up in that historic town?
Well, I'm here right now visiting, so you can see that I love it. I live in New York City, but I like to come into nature just to calm down, to get back to myself, and kind of like feel like a kid again. Like I'm looking at the trees that I used to climb on when I was younger and the fields that I went through. And it just like grounds me and reminds me who I am. I love both. I love being in the Berkshires and I love being in New York. It's just the way I'm living right now.
So when you were young, settling into bed after a long day at school or play, what did you dream about being when you were all grown up?
Oh, well, I did write this down as a little kid. I wanted to be a dog trainer. That was it. I love animals and I love dogs. I also put a teacher. And, you know, when you're 5 years old, you don't really have we don't have coach, you know, so I said teacher. When I look back, that's what my life has all been about, like teaching, coaching, advice, contributing to people. And I also work with animals. We can talk about that later. So even when I was, a teenager, my friends would come to me or call me on the phone for advice. And my mom remembers like me up being on the phone talking about giving advice. Like, who knows? I'm like a teenager. What advice I have or what wisdom I have? But I guess that's something that was working. So I did that just naturally. And I forgot about that. You know, I went to work in corporations, but it was always about people. I was with sales, marketing, leadership development, coaching. So when I look back, it's all about people and it's all about contribution and it's all about coaching.
It's really interesting. Oftentimes, guests will pivot their career dreams. They'll start off doing one thinking of themselves doing one thing, and then something will redirect them. It sounds to me like from the get-go, you were a natural coach and mentor. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and you remember me that I have brother and sister. They're twins, and they're 2 years younger than me. And I used to play teacher with them. I used to have them sit them down and teach them lessons. Like my mom has talked about that too, and I remember that. So yeah, it's been a natural talent I have, and I like to contribute to people.
What was that memory like? Were you a benevolent teacher?
I think so. I don't think I was a strict teacher, but I remember making them drawing things. I remember teaching them things. You know, I used to make them do plays too. So, you know, I was the older sister, so I used to craft these plays and we would do them in the living room and things like that. So it was fun to have a brother and sister that were willing to play the games that I wanted to play. But that's the beginning of it. It's totally the beginning of it.
So when you progressed your way through middle and high school and then on to college, earn your bachelor's degree.
Psychology. It's all about people.
Yep. You stayed on that track. Did at any point you feel that maybe I'll deviate in any way, or did it just get stronger?
Well, I thought I was going to be a therapist. That's why I did psychology. But then I kind of got more interested in like working, you know, in the instead of doing all that schooling again to be a therapist, I just wanted to go into, you know, just into the corporate world to like be with people and learn. And so I have that background, and I guess I'm still using it, but I didn't go into that. I went into corporations and did that inside. You know, I've been an internal coach. I've, you know, done a lot of marketing, like I said, leadership, coaching, training. So it's all connected. And I'm glad I didn't go down that route to just be a psychiatrist or something. I've had a much more broad and fun and interesting career, what I did, kind of accidentally.
Well, I'm glad you didn't go down that path. Psychologists and psychiatrists are among the most uninspired, beat up professionals that I've ever known about.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make a lot of money, and yet so much is put upon them, and they burn out.
Yes, it's a stressful thing to hear all the things that are going on with the human experience. It really is.
Indeed. But back to your schooling, you know, when I was recruiting throughout a 20-year career, I often dealt with a lot of people who specialized in their education. They got maybe double degrees in business and economics or psychology, if you will. But you tended to follow more of a liberal arts track. How did that advantage you, do you think?
I'm so grateful for that. I kind of ended up at Smith. When I was in high school, they came and recruited some young women to go to visit for a day to see what it was like. And I was like, I don't want to go to a girls' school. I want to go to like, you know, a mainstream like UMass or something like that.
Oh yeah.
But I'm glad that I did do that, because here in the Berkshires and in Massachusetts, people think broadly.
Mm.
Like I that started here. Like there's a lot of open ideas and conversations. And I think that's the beginning. Also going to Smith, it's a liberal arts college. So there were no rules. Like I left my parents' house where I had to come back at 10 every night.
Oh.
We had no rules. I was like, I didn't know how to operate. Like there's no rules. No one's going to check up on me. I'm not going to get in trouble. Like they treat us like an adult, like day one. And also there's no real curriculum, you know, cause it's liberal arts. So that was also hard for me too. Like isn't there a schedule, like something I need to follow? So that was hard for me to work in like that nebulous kind of liberal arts thing, but it's the best thing for me because it taught me how to think, how to process things and to learn and to be open. So I started with going into pre-med because I thought I was going to be a vet. They weed me out right away because it was very difficult.
Oh, it
especially,
is.
Chemistry did it. And then I did some psychosocial there at the Weider course. So like, I can't do this. Get me out. And then I did some courses on the environment, and then I found psychology, and that ended up being my concentration, let's say. And I really recognize Smith for creating my personality and my life today, even though it was really hard in the beginning.
You know, it's so interesting. Liberal arts education is like the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually quite pleased about it. Out of that come people who become professionals who can think about a wide range of topics. And there's something to be said about a generalist education that touches a lot of different schools of thought. So good on you.
Yeah.
So how did you pivot from your education into the corporate ranks? And again, you followed your childhood dream of helping people, and that got you into training. How did that evolve?
Well, it's only when you look back that you see the story, I always say. So, of course, my first job was in Boston, mm-hmm. and it was actually accounting, because there was the job wasn't very good at that time. So I learned how to do accounting. Not my skill, but it was helpful. And after that job, I left because there were no jobs for me, like working with people, like you're saying. So what I did is I got out of my apartment. I put my stuff and I put it somewhere. And then I went to Europe, so by myself, for 3 months. And that set me free. I was, you know, didn't have accountable to things. I could just explore. I met a lot of people. I saw different ways of living and working. And it really, like, charged me up. Got my confidence back. Like, you know, traveling by yourself could be scary, or it could be give you lots of confidence, and it did both for me. But I came out with a lot of confidence.
Where'd you go?
Oh, I landed in London, and I left out of Rome, and I went through almost all those countries in between.
Wow!
And I knew some people, so I was meeting up with people, or a lot of times I was on my own, or I was meeting strangers and having great adventures. One of my favorite moments of that time when I was like 23 is I did paragliding. So they brought us up on this big mountain, and this is in Switzerland. And I got up there and I said, I can't do it. And they're like, there's no choice. You can't go back.
Yeah.
So I had to do it. And that was the first time that I got present moment. I don't know when people, you know, when you meditate, you get this present moment now. I can do it now. But that was the first time. This was a big deal for me. You're so scared, and you're the overload of stimulus coming in. It makes your brain go clear. And I was like, oh, this is what it is. This is what being present is. This is what living feel. I felt so excited, and I was seeing every second of everything very present. So that was actually a big deal for me. I was so terrified to do it. But once we got in the air, I felt this whole bliss. And even today, when I get into like struggles, or if I feel anxiety, I bring back that feeling, and I can see it right now when I'm talking to it, like just like yesterday. So that's one of my anchors. And that was the first time I got that open, I'm safe, you know, this blank place that I can create things, and I'm not worrying, and my mind is not running. So that was the biggest, I mean, a lot of things happened during that time, but that was one of the biggest thing that changed my life.
Did you feel like your body changing? Did you feel a calmness? Did you feel your heart rate going down?
Yeah, everything slowed down.
Wow.
I felt bliss. I felt happy. As soon as we got off the ground, I felt that bliss. So it's just because there's just so much stimulus, and there's nothing you can do. So here, I think your mind just says, let's just enjoy this. And yeah, that was when I was young, that was my first time of being present, kind of what meditation is like. And just to trust the process. trust that it's safe, trust that I'm going to be of faith. And I do that for my clients as well. A lot of people come to me very terrified because they've lost their job or something's happened to them. I tell them it's all going to work out. Like, let's calm down. But that was my first time of that really special feeling. And sometimes when I meditate, I bring that back and I can see it just like I did it yesterday.
That's so good to hear. You know, a lot of us who came out of creative fields, I was in advertising for 15 years. You can't get any more panic-driven than an ad agency or that kind of environment. Visualizing helped me get out of some really tough spots, some rough spots. You went to your happy place. Mine was a white sandy beach in the tropics. And I closed my eyes and I would imagine smelling salt air and feeling the trade winds on me. And it works.
We could do that. You can actually smell it. Like if you, I'm sure you can.
Yeah,
like instead of like, once you pretend or you bring it, you actually can smell it. You can actually feel the breeze. Like that's kind of happens to me. I'm sure it happens to you.
That is a gift that you give your clients. That cannot be understated. So when you and I first met, it was in New York, I think. And
yes.
It was at a sustainability conference sponsored by one of the companies where you worked. I happened to be in New York promoting my first book. And what I noticed is that you really, really embrace sustainability and corporate social responsibility. It became a big part of your career story. And I'm wondering, what drew you to the so-called green spaces?
Again, I think it's growing up here in New England. Mm. Like, I grew up in nature. I grew up in responsibility, you know, sustainability. Everything here is very different. And here I was in New York. So not only did that program put me on the map, is that it changed me because I had a secret. I had not just a fear, but a phobia of public speaking. And I started creating this program. We were just doing it to get money. You know, that's what you do in marketing. And like, let's do all these campaigns to get some companies come in, bring more money. That's what about. And HSBC actually had a history of sustainability. So it worked. I was into it. HSBC has a whole legacy of it. So it was just an ordinary time to get money from other clients like that, really. And then it went big. Like everyone, once they saw people like you interview me, a lot of people interview me, they're asking questions. And then I was going on the circuit, like doing my presentation about it. I did 20 across the nation. It was really surprising. But what was the most important for me about that, not only that I loved the message that I was doing and it was doing good work, is that I had a secret, that I had a phobia of public speaking. So the first two times when someone called me on the phone and said, hi, we'd like to have you come and speak at our whatever, I said, oh, I can't. They wouldn't allow me. And I would just hang up because I was so terrified. Like I used to turn red, lose my voice. Like it's so terrible for me to do that. And then by the third call, I was like, oh, this is something really good. I actually want to do this. So I did a cash course on myself. I went to Toastmasters. I went to somatic exercise. I did singing. I did all kinds of things to break through this phobia. And when I got to my first speech, which I forgot where that was, it was not good, but at least I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, this is where the coaching came. I realized I can change because I thought that was a permanent thing for me. I would never be able to speak in front of people. I would always lose my voice, you know, because I was so stressed. I wasn't a good, great speaker. You know, those are my stories I had about myself. But I think I ended up doing 20 or 30 across the nation. And that became my passion and another skill for my clients. So I teach public speaking now. I do career change. I work with millennials and I help people with their speech because I know what it feels like when you're standing up there, you're scared, you don't know how to put a speech together. When you have something that you can't do, especially for me, I study it entirely. So I know everything about public speaking, and that's why I can teach it to people. So I actually teach in schools. I work with CEOs who have to do speeches, ordinary people who want to do speeches. And so that sustainable thing really changed my life, you know, being on the stage, you know, feeling important, feeling the message is important. And also I got some skills and it broke through some of my fears and it gave me a lot of more confidence. It was a lot of things happened in that whole time. And so, and that's life. Like every step you do, you learn.
One of the things I learned, a couple of the things that helped me deal with my anxiety of public speaking was being on the radio. One of my mentors said to me, think of yourself as having a conversation with one person. It's less daunting than thinking about broadcasting out to tens of thousands of people. I use that skill in public speaking as well. I'll arbitrarily pick out three people in the audience to focus on. I find it helps me. Does something like that happen to you as well?
In the beginning, I could only see the first row.
Ah.
And then I learned to look out and out. And so I could look in the way back. I could be calm and I would choose to look at someone. Like what I do is I choose someone whose eyes and I talk to them for a little while on the right. Then I look back and I look on someone else on the left. And I really look, I do connect eye to eyes with people that are looking at me. Because some people are falling asleep and people are looking at their phones. No judgment. But there's some people that are really listening. And they could be in the back. And so I was so calm after that I could actually look at actual people. Like I look at this person, then I look at this person, and look at this person. Took a long time. From how I started to where I ended, it's really amazing. And that's also what I do for my clients. Mm. Like you can come over things. You can do it. I came over my biggest fear of public speaking. And now I'm like teaching it today. It's filthy crazy to me. So that's how I give confidence, you know, to my clients. And I'm working with in the schools with young people, so they don't have to suffer as much as I did. I did up till 35, you know, 35 years of hiding from public speaking. So they're getting it at 19, you know. So that's what I want for them, because it's really important to be able to share your ideas and your programs and teach people and not to be so scared.
Well, good on you, because you come across as naturally extroverted and gregarious. When I first met you, I thought that's the way you were. So you're doing something right.
No, there's a little bit of showtime when you do public speaking. There is. You have to be extroverted to do public speaking. If you know Myers-Briggs, I'm an INTP, which they call the robot. I'm not a robot, but I understand why they say that, because we're very analytical. And I have to move some energy to, you know, to teach and to train and to present. But it's not easy. After I do a speech, I kind of have to go by myself. Like I have to go and like just calm down. Extroverts get more energy when they talk. You know, introverts, we do our speech and like, okay, I got to go take a nap. So that's kind of what happens.
I'm an ENTP.
Uh-huh, that's right. We talked about that. Mm-hmm.
So, like me, you are a corporate escapee. I'm curious to know what exited you out of the corporate ranks to be an entrepreneur that helps people.
Honestly, it was layoffs. I've been laid off a couple times just because of the market. Like, HSBC had a lot of troubles. The last one was CIT. They got taken over. I worked for 17 magazine. They got like, that was during, you know, the crisis, all the crisis, like then we all got laid off. So I've been got laid off a couple of times and it always forced me to innovate. So the first time I got laid off, I went, got my MBA. The second time I got my coaching credentials, you know, like there's every time I had a breakdown, I decided to just dig in and do something else to advance my stuff. And that's how I help people also in my career coaching. If they get laid off or if they're about to get laid off or they're looking for a job, I know the tools how to do it because I've gone through multiple, you know, layoffs. That's how it started with Career Charts. Like I learned how to do it and now I help people, and there's no judgment if you get laid off or if you leave a job. You know, it's all about looking forward.
I think there is no more anxiety-inducing experience than knowing you're about to be laid off and then being laid off. Like you, I've been laid off a few times. One time was on my birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
We have a present for you. You're getting laid off.
One time was at Christmas break. They called it the Christmas present. The company I worked for called it the Christmas present. Yeah. And the anxiety comes from being around people who don't know how to engage with you. And I once wrote down, I found the journal that I wrote the first time I got laid off, and I wrote the following words: I feel like I'm at my own funeral.
Let's say it's like a death of the old you.
Yes.
Like I said, every layoff I have, every change, I grew.
I agree.
Kind of out of pain. I get it. But every layoff I have got me to another place. So I'm thankful for it, although it's terrifying and like, but it is. It's a death of the old you, and you have these. Look where you are today. If they didn't lay you off, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing today.
Agreed.
And you wouldn't have all of that empathy and all these skills. And so I'm glad you got laid off.
I would not change it for the world. You know, for people that say, oh, I wish it didn't happen to me, I don't say those things. No. These things happen for a reason.
Mm-hmm. And it's only when you look back that you see how it was good for you. When you're in it, you're like, this is terrible. I don't want to tell my family. I don't want anyone to know. Like some people on their LinkedIn, they keep their job on there.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I got laid off 6 months ago. I'm like, what is your, like, you know, they feel shame and fear. And, you know, it's only when you look back, when you realize that was such a good thing for you.
I don't think I could have been so public about ending my recruiting career and literally blowing up my company and making that a narrative without the experience of being laid off a few times.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, one of the aspects of your work is working with millennials, which at this point is the largest part of our workforce. And you're not part of the millennial generation, but you got the name Queen of Millennials.
Yes.
How did that happen?
So this happened when I was at HSBC. I went through a leadership program there. And after that, I was in marketing. After that, they move you to a new position. So I love that leadership development so much that they offered me to create the entry-level leadership development, and I move into HR.
Mm.
I had no experience for that. I had just gone through a year-long program, so I kind of understood. So also with HSBC, they didn't have any young people. Like it started at like 30. We didn't have anyone young. So then I'm in HR, you know, I had no experience creating things, but my love from the program I just went through, I created it for entry, you know, coming out of college. So we didn't even know they were millennials. We didn't have that word, you know, just
right.
The graduates, you know, so that word wasn't even around. And we created the new program. Trust me, like 30,000 people applied for it. It's so easy. You just press a button, you know, so there was a million. So we had to narrow it down to 30. So I had 30 employees going through my program, which was a 2-year program. And we hired every year. So at one point I had 40 and then the other ones rolled off. So I hired 60 of them over that time.
Oh my goodness.
You know, think about this. All these people, these bankers, you know, 30 and older, and these millennials come in like with a very different culture. I love their culture. They make things easy. They don't waste their time. They're really eager. They're looking for coaching. How I started coaching them is they were asking me for coaching. Would you coach me? Would you give me some feedback? And I was like, this is strange because that never happens in corporations. So then I set up a system like there's 30 of them. Every month I coached them, you know, for an hour personally. And that was getting me, you know, 30 hours of coaching. I was racking up all these hours. And that's when I went to Columbia to get my credentials. So I loved them. They were my people. And they really revived me. You know, being in a corporation and it was around 2008, 2009 with the crisis, so everything was so depressing.
Yeah.
They were such a bright people coming in, like, can do. They were asking me for work. Like, they come to me, like, what else can I do? I want to do something else. Would you coach me? Would you tell me what I'm doing? And it was a very different culture than, like, Gen X. Gen X, we kind of just hide under our desk and hope everything goes well. We don't want to hear any criticism.
Right.
You know, we don't want to have any coaching. I don't want talking about that. But they're very different. They're very open. They tell me all the things they're doing. Like, I can talk to them almost like a person, one to one. So I just fell in love with the way they are. And most people don't, I understand, but I really love them. And then at the end of the first group that I had, we were like having a wrap up and a saying goodbye. One of them said, like, you're the only one who likes us. No one else in the company likes us. You're the only one who likes us. You're like the queen of the millennials. And I'm like, oh, ding. And I went on GoDaddy and I got the URL. And I just put up a little site up like that. And people love that.
That is so smart that you acted on that so quickly.
Yeah, because it was so just felt ringing my ears when they said that. You're the queen of the millennials. I'm like, yes. We just take that. Yeah. It's fun. I mean, they're still around with me.
Yeah.
They've come back to me. We have conversations. I'm in contact with all of them. It really, like, I always say people forget how they were young. So when I was working with them, I felt youthful again. I remembered things I did when I was young. So I think it's good to be in touch with young people because it'll make you feel young and remember yourself when you were young.
You mentioned something about their youthful exuberance, which, you know, thinking back when I was younger, I was at the tail end of the baby boomers, and the narrative was really written by my older cohorts to be self-reliant, to never show your vulnerability.
Right.
This generation turned that upside down. Why do so many generations that preceded them, well, Gen Xers and baby boomers, have so much trouble with that? Is it threatening?
Yeah, people don't like to show their vulnerability, their mistakes. Some reason, like, you know, millennials, they started social media, right?
Right.
They share everything, the good, the bad, the weird, and they're proud of it. They're sometimes very transparent. They would tell me things, crazy things they did or bad things they did for me to help them.
Mm.
And the other thing, I mean, I've looked into a lot of millennials. We could another conversation on that, is that they were friends with their parents. Like,
yeah.
I would never say I was friends with my parents. They were my parents. But they shared everything with their parents. Their parents are like their friends. So they talk very explicit and honest, and they would tell me if they did something bad or something, and it was interesting to deal with that because they would just spill the beans because they just wanted coaching and they wanted to change it or they wanted to make it better. So, and I heard a lot of stuff about personal stuff. Like, they mix it all together, work, personal, this, that, home, you know, what's happened in the past. So I liked it because I could feel the pulse on them, like what's going on with them. They were sharing me what's going on so I could help them. And that's what they wanted. They're sharing all that because they want to be helped. They want to be coached. They want to do better.
So one of the things that you do is work with companies and organizations to guide them in how to work best with millennial talent. Can you share with us some of the things that they come to you with, some of the things they need to learn or overcome or understand that you help them get to those answers?
They mostly want to understand, in corporations, they mostly understand why they're so vocal. They're always going to their manager saying, what else can I do? What else can I do? And they say everything and they use their tools, you know. So corporations, it's like a culture clash, like Gen X's and baby boomers, you hide your mistakes. Millennials just say it out. And I have two programs, like you said, Millennial Mindset and motivating millennials, and I go into people to talk to. So millennials, their parents were working, right? And they also saw their parents go through the crisis. Maybe they lost a house, maybe they lost a job. You know, they saw that happen. Mm-hmm. So, and they're very close to their parents. So they share everything with their parents. Like, I'm a Gen X. I don't tell my parents anything. That's how we grew up. So they speak freely. So when I was working with them, they would just tell me everything, just get it all out. Mm-hmm. In corporations, that's not what you do.
That's
You hide your emotions. You go cry in the closet or something, you know, or you take a walk, or you just pretend that you're strong. You know, baby boomers especially, they do not show any emotion. It's all about the work, and that's fulfillment for them. And sometimes they seem harsh, baby boomers. Like, millennials seem as harsh because they're just all about the work. And I don't want to hear your personal stuff. And millennials think like, well, I need to work through this personal stuff so I can do good work.
Right.
And the baby boomers are like, who cares? You know, just do work, you know, just go up the ladder.
Yeah.
And who cares if you don't, you know, who cares if you don't like this job that you're doing, or if it's, you know, if it's not what's for you. They're looking for experiences, places, a place where they can contribute, where they can connect with people, that they can do a good job. They all want that. They want to do a good job. They want to have a good manager who contributes to them, like a parent, I say. And it's just very different than for much from baby boomers and Gen Xers. And once you understand that, I hate to say this, but it's almost like a parent. Because their parents weren't around, sometimes they feel their manager should be kind of like a parent to them, and also a corporation could be a parent to them. That's what I've researched and much that I've seen, that it takes care of you. And if it doesn't, you leave.
Well, I can't speak for you, but I know for my generation, when you got out of college, your parents wanted you off the books. They wanted you out, getting an apartment, bootstrapping and a new job, learning how to manage money. It was terrifying. We got there.
Without guidance.
Right,
Gen
exactly.
X had no guidance.
No guidance.
And you didn't want to tell your parents that you were, like, at least me, that I was scared, that I wanted to go back home. Like, no. Like, I didn't tell them anything about all the things that happened. I just had, you know, that's what Gen X's are.
Right.
We just go on our own and, like, take it on the chin. And just keep going and not show anything. Millennials are different. They'll come to you like, I don't know how to use this. I don't like this. Can you tell? They're very engaging. And I like that. I like that transparency. If I know what's going on with them, and then I can contribute to them, and I can help them or fix them, whatever's going on. That's my thing that I like about them.
One of the conversations I used to have with my hiring managers was out of frustration that the new hire, if the person was a millennial, didn't know how to manage the day, the clock. And I think back to when I was, I don't know, first grade or kindergarten, and my teacher would hold up this analog clock and say, okay, we have 24 hours and you can split that three ways. And here are 8 hours that you rest, and here are 8 hours that you go to work. And these other 8 hours are for other things.
Well, that's awful. Go ahead. Keep going.
And then my friends and fellow millennial channelers, Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes, who've written several books on millennials, said something that really resonated, which is that work isn't the day. It's done during the day. It's part of the day. And that a millennial might want to break up their day and go out and do something fun, maybe go watch their kid play soccer, or do social media, or be mellow with their friends. Exactly.
Yep.
And my hiring managers didn't know how to deal with that. So, Your Majesty, you work with your people. What can you tell that hiring manager that they need to do to chill out and make it work?
Millennials will work very hard for you if you kind of give them the freedom like you just talked about. They'll work very hard for you and be loyal to you if you're transparent, if you give them advice and coaching. they don't believe in sitting in your seat from 9 to 5. Like, how many of us, whether it's baby boomers or Gen X's, we're sitting in our seat just waiting for 5. We don't have any work, but what we do, you know, we have to be seen in our seat looking at our computer from 9 to 5. They're like not into that. They're like, why? Work and life has kind of like moved together with them. So they would be happy to log on at night and do something. But during the day, if they have somewhere to go, or, you know, or they want to come in later, or they, it's all mixed up for them. It's not the 9 to 5 that we experienced. And also, you don't have to be seen there. Like, your boss often wants to see you sitting in your seat in front of at your desk, right? That's the old school.
Right.
They can work from anywhere. I have a client. I had a client who, this is what we did together, is that she wanted to go around the world. She wanted to take a break for 3 months for her job, but she wanted to still keep working because she loved her job.
Mm.
So I worked with her on this, and we did a proposal to her boss saying that I will still be working, you know, the 9 to 5 for in the United States. But I want to go around the world and have an experience, and I want to stay with the company. I want to do that. And they were talking about maybe she takes time off, or maybe, but she's like, no, I want to keep working. So she did, it was 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
She went around the world and she visited all these places, and she did all her work virtually. And like, her parents and also my boss, who I work with and coach mentors, was like, I don't know if this is going to work, but it worked. And she's a top person in her company. She's very professional. She's trustworthy, and it worked. And she did her work while she was traveling all around the world, Asia, Thailand, Europe. She went everywhere, and they don't care where we do it, how we do it. We just do it. They want to live, you know, like, you know, how it is right now, like baby boomers or Gen X's, you know, we work. We get off at 65. And then maybe you get sick and you die. You know, that's no fun. So they're mixing it all together, like working and playing and having experiences just to enrich their life. Like, why wait? That's kind of their thing. Why wait to 65?
But I think millennials, by choice but also by circumstance, have adopted the tenets of meaningful work, work that's profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do. And what you just described to me is somebody who wanted more meaningfulness out of their work by incorporating the other parts of her day.
Seeing the world. Yeah.
That's really encouraging. So let's turn to you. What makes the work that you do for your clients meaningful?
Oh, everything. When they get their next job, when they feel hopeful, when they feel excited about what they're doing, I find them. Like, you could, someone wrote that on one of my testimonials. I have tools where we go back to, like, what did you want to be when you were 5 years old? You know, what are your strengths? Like, that's the best one. Like, people are shocked. Like, what? And often what you wanted in 5 is sort of your passion, whether you're 30 or 40. When I bring people back to that, they're like, oh, yeah, when I was 4 or 5, I wanted to do X. And it's still there in their heart. It's a really special question that I ask, and it breaks it all up. I give people a new career, for sure, or I do public speaking, for sure. But what I really do is I help them find themselves. Like, what's inside of them? What are their dreams? You know, what are their skills? And it's just wonderful. Like, people come to me, maybe they're resigned, even depressed. They leave going, knowing who they are, you know, what their talents are, what they want to do. And it's very easy. Once you have your passion and your skills lined up, it's very easy to get a job because, okay, check the box. You have all the skills, but it's the passion and bringing your real self to the job is the extra magic, I'd say.
You're very lucky.
How so?
Well, and I think we share this attribute to get to the point where what you're doing in your life is helping other people live their dreams Something very gratifying mm-hmm. about that.
It is. Mm-hmm. That's what I want for people. I want them. I don't want my sentence. I don't want them to suffer. I want them, and that's for animals too, and that's for the environment. Don't want anyone to suffer. So if I can help someone to get them their next step, or while they work with me, they feel good and they feel positive. That just works for me. That makes me happy. Makes me fulfilled.
So I have a few more questions, and one of them has to do with an interest that we share in what is called localism. It's mm-hmm. a new trend in sort of the zeitgeist, if you will, that people are focusing more on where they live and not so much on the big picture of the United States. And where that plays out is because, well, let's face it, Congress doesn't do a lot other than fight with each other. And so real decision-making and real things are happening at the localist of levels, cities, small towns, communities, neighborhoods. And I think you and I share this interest. You indicated to me that a dream you have is to someday to return to the town where you're speaking to me today. So if you moved, would you continue serving your millennial subjects?
Oh, yes. Yes, the queen will still do her work. I want both. I want to keep my apartment in New York or have a place to be. It just gives me so much great energy. And I love here in the Berkshires. So one thing that you're talking about local, something that's going on in here is called Makers. This is an old, Massachusetts is where, 1620 started.
Right.
this is Massachusetts. And the Berkshires is all about small businesses, things that are needed and some that are purposeful. Mm. Like there's a lot of stuff here. Like someone's doing wool, someone's cooking food. There's all kinds of things going on. And there's this whole movement called the Makers.
Right.
So that's what I've gone on to a couple events like that. And it's really inspirational and positive about bringing about, there's doers, there's things like that, but this is Makers. So we make things here. It's like going back to 1620 pretty much. So there's a new thing about what we do and why we have value and how we can have people understand what's going here, how we can create a community here, an economy here, mm-hmm. because this is a wonderful place to live. I grew up here like it was like paradise. I used to, just like all of us, I used to just leave my house, be gone all day. My parents never knew where I was. Just say, come back until the streetlights come back on. That was me. We'd be in someone's houses. We'd be in the fields. We'd be swimming. Who knows? It was such a safe and wonderful place. And so we're trying to bring that back here because it's a great place to live. Four seasons, nice people. No one's yelled at me here. In New York, I get yelled at, like, what are you doing? Here, everyone's very nice and kind. And there's a lot of potential here, and I want to come back and help here, whatever I can do, whether it's coaching or, using my MBA to create businesses. It's just a very special place here that needs to be regenerated.
The Maker movement really fascinates me. It's almost like a pushback against 30 or 40 years of hegemony of a service economy, where we just service things, we don't build things anymore. My nephew has a 3D printer. He makes stuff. He's not doing it for a career right now. He may eventually. He works for a big corporation, but his fun time is making stuff.
Yeah, it feels good to do real physical things. Like, even for me, I'm doing all this stuff online, but it feels good. Like, this is silly, but not silly. I'm here, my parents have a big garden in the background.
Mm.
So I've been tending that. Like, I love doing that. Like, my hands in the soil, looking at the tomatoes, like, nurturing all this. Like, that, like, I haven't felt that in a long time. Like, everything's virtual in New York, and everything in New York is kind of done for you. But to, like, get your hands in the soil or to touch actual things or to, like, mow the lawn, like, things I haven't done in a long time is really grounding me. And that's why I think I came here, is to get grounded and, to have your bare feet in the grass, also being this maker movement, it's very grounding here, very different. New York is kind of a little spacey sometimes because what do you do? Everything's virtual, or what do you really do? Here, people know what they're doing, you know, because they're making things, they're making actual things that are needed in the world.
A lot of meaningful works, meaning is going to come out of the maker movement, because it goes back. You mentioned 1620. Okay, the colony, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, had a lot of makers. The makers were represented by guilds. There's nothing older or more traditional than the idea of a guild. It perpetuates skill. It perpetuates the meaning of what you do.
In New England, we have, I don't want to call it religion, we have belief. So here, people are honest. People are have meaningful things to do. You know, it's a little different than New York. I'm not saying New York is different. But you can feel the purpose here and the meaningful and the hard work. And it's really helped me quite a bit, even with my consultancy. This vibe of value and meaningful and really helping someone and really creating something physical.
That's a beautiful mind picture you just drew.
Good.
So put on your futurist cap for me for a minute, if you would, Nicole, and tell me what you think the future 30 years out will look like in terms of what will make a workplace successful.
I think the work time is going to shorten. I think we're going to have so many things that are make automation, and people are waking up to just not sitting in your seat from 5 to 9 just for to be seen. I hope the maker thing has an impact where people really create things again, and that we have tools. Like, millennials have brought all these tools, you know, all these apps and all these things that make things easier. Like, already all that stuff you used to do, like, is now done by an app. We have automation. I would like the work life to be shorter, or to do like my client did. You can work for wherever. So you can have a good life, and you can do good work, and you have good outcomes, instead of this 9 to 5. You see, New York people are like running, like when they're to get to 9, like they're late or something, right? They have a coffee in their hand and they're running down the street to get to their seat at 9. So their manager sees them. And then at 5, like, whoosh, all these people go out. Like, they're just, you know, there's a lot of wasted time in there. Also, it's not great for well-being to sit down for 7 hours in your seat.
That's right.
I would like to have more movement, you know, more people or an ordination, like, working differently. We don't have to have the 9 to 5 anymore. We can work wherever. There's a lot of shortcuts and apps and different ways to do things, and also to focus on what the outcome is, like something physical or something that you can really see how it helps something, or something physical, or like, because right now we're in transition. Like, right. I believe it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen soon, and the millennials are now the dominant culture. I'm sure you know.
Yes.
This year, they have overcome all of us. They're the biggest cohorts.
Right.
And I love their values and what they want. So it's going to start to change. They're more about living their life, values, doing good work, but not sitting in your seat. And that's why a lot of people are sick. Like, some people in New York, they take 2 hours to come down to Manhattan. They're sitting on the train for 2 hours.
I did.
Waking up early. They don't have enough sleep. They're sitting. They get to their desk. They sit for 7 hours. Then they go back. How does that work with your family? How does it work with your well-being and when you eat or your exercise or your body or your mind? Like, how can that be good for us?
It's not. I did it for years. It was terrible.
Yeah. Something has to change.
Well, you've described the future. You talked a little bit about AI. AI, I think, terrifies a lot of people. But I think the flip of that is AI doesn't have a heart. People, humanity, have hearts.
Mm-hmm.
The work of makers is very heartbound. And
yes.
I think maybe if AI frees us from doing monotonous jobs, maybe we can liberate ourselves to do more jobs with a heart. How do you feel about that?
I like that. I like the physical, like touching things, actually your hands are doing things, or you're stirring up sauce because you're making a sauce, you're a sauce maker or something like that, or you make wool or clay or things like that, or you're farming. Mm-hmm. It does feel good. And that's what I was missing. And that's what I've been doing all summer. I've been like in the garden, mowing the lawn, like seeing the moon, seeing the stars. Mm. Like it's really nice to get grounded into the earth, the sky, you know, the animals, like they're all around us. That's, we're missing that when we're sitting in a corporation all day long. And it's not efficient. It's not good for the human heart or mind.
Well, this conversation has left me very hopeful. You've identified some areas where I think work will get more meaningful, and I'm very encouraged by that.
I'm thinking about putting maker in my name now. I'm thinking about it when we're talking about this, but I'm a maker.
You're a maker.
I'm a maker. Mm-hmm.
Nicole Russo, thank you so much for being on The Tightrope. If somebody wanted to find you and learn more about the work that you do and the value that you extend to people, how would they find you on social media?
So I have two sites. One is coachablesolutions.com. And the other one that we've talked about, queenofthemillennials.com.
Well, thank you so much for being on The Tightrope.
And thank you. This was fun.
Our thanks go out to Nicole Russo for walking the tightrope with us. Links to her social media can be found on the show notes page for this episode at dansmolin.com. Our success is your success, but we cannot build our community without your help and support. So if you haven't done so already, please join the Dan Smolin Experience to get our newsletter offering information, tips, and hacks to help you succeed in doing meaningful work. To sign up, simply click the Subscribe to the Dan Smolin Experience newsletter button on our homepage at dansmolin.com. Fill out the short form, then click the Subscribe button at the bottom of the page, and you'll be on your way. Also, become a regular listener of the Tightrope with Dan Smolin podcast. You can easily find current and past episodes by keywording The Tightrope with Dan Smolin at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, on our website at dansmolin.com, or wherever you choose to listen. And don't forget to show your support on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. You can locate our social media buttons at the upper right corner of our webpages at dansmolin.com. From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin, and do remember this. Our best days lie ahead. Have a great and successful week, everyone.